You're listening to American Songcatcher, tracing the roots of American music from its cultured past to today's artists playing it forward. I'm folk musician Nicholas Edward Williams.
There is no rhythm in the world without movement first. Your rhythms on this earth first began with the beat of your heart. Your rhythm, your blood, your heart.
In the days of 18 and 1, hey, you know. In the days of 18 and 1, hey, you know.
I think the other thing that was really admirable about Mo was he had a high tolerance for eccentric people. He loved people that were kind of outside of the norms.
One of the most notable eccentrics around Mo during the early 1950s was artist, filmmaker, bohemian mystic, and varietal collector Harry Smith. In the 1940s, Harry dropped out of college, hoboed around the boroughs of San Francisco, and crashed on the celebrated poet and writer Allen Ginsberg's couch, then became highly regarded in both the experimental film and abstract painting scene, and he started collecting odd things, Easter eggs, paper airplanes, and string art. Then, for a time, Harry found work at a very lucrative job.
He's a small fella, hunchback a little bit, who was able to go in the tail of a plane. They needed small guys to do that. And they earned a fortune, something like $100 an hour or something. They took all this money and he bought all those Black Label records.
No one else seemed to care about these old records that people were donating for the war, which made them even more appealing to Harry. So he bought them up like a fanatic, acquiring nearly 1,000 wax cylinders and 78s during what's called the shellac shortage. Harry's collection included the rare and exotic, to pre-war race records, a term that he despised, portions of the catalog from ballad collector Francis Child, Irish and Japanese traditional music, Woody Guthrie, and hillbilly records, another term that he didn't care for. The way Mo told the story was that Harry came to him, intent on issuing an anthology with his collection through Folkways. Harry insisted that he was merely short on cash and was trying to sell his collection to Mo, and that it was all Mo's idea to turn it into a three-series anthology, complete with scholarly liner notes.
So there was one desk in, like, the size of a closet. Mo gave Harry space and said, you know, you can work on this project. And that was the start of the anthology.
For the next few months, Harry went through his collection in the Folkways office, with daily encouragement needed from Mo, reportedly with a peyote button or two, to fuel Harry's inspiration. In all, he chose 84 songs, all recorded between 1927 and 1932, and Mo released three volumes of two LPs in 1952, titled The Anthology of American Folk Music, today considered a holy grail in American roots music. To blur the lines of race and hillbilly music, Harry juxtaposed selections to prove the influence that white and black musicians had on each other's music.
I woke up this morning, 4 o'clock, Mr. Case told if I'm getting his ball a hot.
Tell me, ladies and gentlemen, listen to the song. Sang it to you right, but you might think it's wrong.
In a little more,
I woke up this morning between 1 and 2.
The anthology became, quote, the most important collection of its type, according to Mo.
You know, before the Anthology of American Folk Music, if you wanted to buy a folk record, it was going to be sort of a polished thing on RCA. It would be like Richard Dyer Bennett or Burl Ives or, you know, somebody with some crooning folk songs.
This is Jeff Place,
I founded the Smithsonian Folklife Archive in 1988 when we started Smithsonian Folkways Recordings, Tony Seeger and I.
He also completely organized and digitized Moe's entire collection.
You know, this really kind of raw, rootsy stuff, no one had really heard it. And so after that, people started scouting all sorts of other music like that.
That led to nationwide searches by amateur musicologists and enthusiasts and, quote, discoveries of artists like Mississippi John Hurt, Doc Boggs, Bascom Lamar Lunsford, Furry Lewis, Clarence Tom Ashley, and countless others that informed the present generations of their musical past. Tony Seeger, former director of Smithsonian Folkways, stated that the anthology, quote, transformed the way that people thought about folk music. Suddenly, there was this real and different history in the United States of what sounds people could make.
Frankie was a good girl, everybody know. She paid $100 for out one suit of clothes. He's a man, and he done her wrong.
The ripple effect of the anthology was so thorough that it muddied the waters of the music industry, who for over 30 years had fought hard to create categories of white and black markets. The folk music scene had already been adopting old songs documented in books by musicologists such as John and Alan Lomax, as well as Sing Out magazine and old 78s that could be dug up. But presenting the three volumes as Harry Smith did was educational, humanitarian, and inspiring. It affected folk music's visibility, thrusting it into the mainstream, and infusing it with the politics of the times.
A city of lives, and the lives of cities too. While LB Killer Johnson and his Napalm Boys are singing by their fire. So, what do a few crimes matter in a normal life? They prey the insignificance of most neutral behavior. I thank you.
Led by early momentum from Woody Guthrie and the Weavers, folk singers in the mid-1950s began to put pro-civil rights and anti-war feelings front and center. Its influence was even felt by Congress, particularly Senator Joseph McCarthy, who began to consider all folk music as a tool of various political movements, deeming them socialistic and anti-American, instituting the second, quote, Red Scare, blacklisting writers, actors, and musicians, for any possible communist involvement or sympathy.
The growing menace of communism arouses the House of Representatives Un-American Activities Committee. Among the well-informed witnesses...
I think we've got a much more serious situation now in communist infiltration of the CIA. Disturbs me beyond words.
Well, we haven't. The members of the committee have not been advised...
Early one morning, got an invitation to help Congress out in an investigation. Man came around and knocking at the door, gave me a paper that said, what for subpoena?
The government's attempts to silence free speech had a chilling effect on the folk revival as a whole. Moe wasn't overtly political, but he absolutely defended the human right to free thought, and he cared deeply for many of the artists that he worked with on a regular basis. So he got creative.
He, kept Pete Seeger going in the 50s when he was blacklisted. You know, he would sign him all these projects. There was a period of time when Pete would do 6 or 7 records a year for him. And he'd pick, he'd be reading Bible stories or something, anything, so he could pay him cash to keep him going.
Moe also targeted the one demographic that the government wasn't thinking about, students.
His Folkways Records model wasn't based on record stores. Schools and libraries was his thing. He spent a lot of time going to library conventions and educators' conventions. So all those records got into schools, too.
It made a huge impact, because an entire generation of kids during the 50s and 60s grew up listening to Folkways artists like Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, and Ella Jenkins in school.
The song is called Zimba. Let's say Zimba. Zimba.
Zimba.
Zimba, eh.
Zimba, eh.
Bali, 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 Bali.
Ekwe, Ekwe.
The first lady of children's music, Ella Jenkins, released her first album, Call and Response, Rhythmic Group Singing, with Folkways Records in 1957. Just a year earlier, Ella was, quote, discovered on a sidewalk playing conga drums with a young man in a wheelchair, and the host of a PBS kids show called The Totem Club asked her to come on. It went so well that Ella was given a regular segment called This Is Rhythm, which Mo got word of.
We are the Rhythm Sticks. We go click, 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 click. We are the Rhythm Sticks. We go click, 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 click.
Mo believed that music was a powerful tool for children to learn about cultural heritage, and he encouraged Ella to devote her career to children's music education. She left her job at the YMCA and began her professional career that is still underway today, having released hundreds of children's songs and becoming the first folk artist to teach joyful, interactive, cultural music in schools, laying the groundwork for generations of music teachers and performers of children's music.
Red, blue, yellow, white, and green.
During the early 1950s, pioneering jazz writer and scholar Fred Ramsey went from Saratoga, Florida to New Orleans, Louisiana, in search of what might still remain of original, authentic African-American musical traditions, thanks to a grant from the Guggenheim Fellowship. The end result was a highly influential 10-volume series called Music from the South, released on Folkways between 1955 and 1960. It also featured photographs, interviews, and narratives of Black farmers, railroad workers, housewives, children, church congregations, and country brass bands. It was the first of its kind to document Black music traditions that didn't fall in line with the blues narrative that has been pushed by record companies since the 1920s. For many years, music historian, writer, and producer Sam Charters had been researching the history of jazz, but in the 1950s, he also began to study more rustic Black traditions. He noticed that a recording he had of Robert Johnson was done in San Antonio, so in 1953, he went to Texas, searching for what he could about both Robert Johnson and Texas blues pioneer Blind Willie Johnson. That trip initiated several years of field recordings all over the country that would be put on Folkways Records, notably the first recordings of Bahamian blues guitarist Joseph Spence in 1958. Sam also went on a search for Lightnin' Hopkins, who had disappeared over a decade prior. As the story goes, Sam was asking around about Lightnin' on Dowling Street in Houston, where everyone knew Lightnin', but no one said where he was. Then, Sam pulled up to a red light, and a car pulled up next to him. The window rolled down, and a thin Black man with a Cheshire Cat smile said, "You looking for Lightnin'?" And there he was.
You knew it won. Kind favor I'll ask to you. You know it one kind favor I'll ask to you.
Sam recorded Lightnin' in a hotel room, right after finding him an acoustic guitar, since he didn't have one at the time, and he gave him $200 for the recordings, the equivalent of over $2,000 in today's money. That self-titled Folkways record completely reignited Lightnin's career and inspired a multitude of musicians, such as Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan, Townes Van Zandt, ZZ Top, and Stevie Ray Vaughan, to name a few. That same year, Sam released a book based on his field recordings and searches called The Country Blues, which was the first to shed light on African-American blues history, initiating a massive movement of amateur musicologists to study the lineage. After only 10 years in the business, the wide scope of the Folkways catalog had clearly played an enormous role in the folk and blues revival. While the Red Scare promoted a more distilled and polished version of folk music, as noted by groups like the Kingston Trio, the flip side was the more rugged old-time music from the 1920s and 1930s being brought back into the fold by new folkways recordings from the likes of Doc Boggs, Roscoe Holcomb, Clarence Tom Ashley, and Doc Watson. One important group who captured the unique character of old-time music was the New Lost City Ramblers, and Moe took them under his wing.
Pete Seeger had sort of been doing guerrilla touring, mostly performing at colleges. You know, the dam really burst when the Kingston Trio had the big hit with Tom Dooley.
Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poor boy, you're bound to die.
At the tail end of the Red Scare, the Kingston Trio formed in 1957, and their rearrangement of the North Carolina murder ballad, Tom Dooley, granted them massive success, becoming the song of the summer in 1958, and winning a Grammy for Best Country and Western Recording.
And then all of a sudden, everybody and their uncle had a trio of various kinds, many of which were manufactured, like Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing.
In contrast to the more commercially designed folk groups, the New Lost City Ramblers, founded by Mike Seeger, John Cohen, and Tom Paley in 1958, formed through the gatherings of musicians who came to Washington Square Park in Greenwich Village on Sunday afternoons.
Villagers on a stroll, folk singers, and tourists. The Circle is a good place to meet old friends and make some new ones.
On Sunday afternoons in Washington Square Park, you know, this became sort of this well-known nexus or place for anyone interested in folk music to get together.
In addition to the Ramblers, other well-known musicians who got their feet wet in Washington Square Park include Dave Van Ronk, Joan Baez, Buddy Holly, and Bob Dylan, just to name a few.
In fact, it became so well-known that the city tried to shut it down in about 1961, and there were these famous, what were called the Washington Square Riots, where, you know, these folk musicians were like, we shall not be moved, you know, we have the right to sing folk music. And eventually the city, you know, figured what the hell. So, I mean, in a way, the New Lost City Ramblers were the anti-Kingston Trio.
Now we pay $3 or more, maybe get a shirt that another man wore. Tell me, how can a poor man stand such times and live?
The devotees of the anthology, the Ramblers made a point of going back and finding the craziest obscure 78s and writing liner notes and scholarly explaining them.
Kingston Trio were successful. I mean, they were commercially successful. The New Lost City Ramblers were not anywhere near that league in terms of financing. But Moe, again, was very supportive of them.
Moe had an open-door policy, and in 1958, the group went into the Folkways studio without a name and laid down their first record.
So they were obviously very influenced by Harry Smith's anthology, as a lot of people were, but they took it to the nth degree. In other words, they'd listen to a Charlie Poole 78 and they would reproduce it as closely as they possibly could.
Oh, goodbye, boo. For him, I'm home. My booting days will soon be old. I had a good time.
And a good in degree. You see what boo has done for me.
So their influence was ginormous. They were extremely important. They started the whole old-time revival.
I am a man of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble on my days.
There's a lesser-known story about Bob Dylan leaving Minneapolis before going to New York City in 1961. A local music writer named John Pancake had put him up for the night after a long day busking on the streets. And in the morning, Bob left and stole a few records, including the first New Lost City Ramblers album. 6 months later, Bob was on Dave Van Ronk's couch in Greenwich Village, and John Pancake burst in, having tracked him down to get his records back. He broke a bottle in half and started waving at Bob and screaming until Dave Van Ronk showed up and defused the situation. Bob had just enough time to soak in that first Ramblers record to be greatly informed by it. In his autobiography, Bob said, "Everything about them appealed to me. Their songs rang the gamut in style, everything from mountain ballads to fiddle tunes and railway blues. I'd stay with the Ramblers for days. I didn't know that they were replicating everything they did off of old 78s, but what would it have mattered anyway? They had originality in spades."
On our turpentine farm, uh-huh. On our turpentine farm, uh-huh. Where the work ain't hard, uh-huh. And the weather is warm.
From a preservation standpoint, there is no other group beside the New Lost City Ramblers that has been able to master and parse as much American old-time music from so many places in so many distinctive styles while keeping it true to form. Whether or not Mo knew it, enabling the New Lost City Ramblers to record as they pleased stands among the most important cultural pieces of documentation in the entire Folkways catalog. They were dedicated to making sure that, quote, the true vine, as Mike Seeger put it, continued on. Over their 50-year career, the New Lost City Ramblers set the standard for how to respect our musical elders, and their greatest joy came from introducing musicians who inspired them to new generations who would play it forward.
Working hard, uh-huh. And the weather is warm.
Well, Sir John a wooing came to a lady young and fair. May Calvin was this lady's name, and her father's only heir. Her father's only heir.
Mo worked with several musicians that were also scholars or musicologists, including members of the Ramblers. One of the most significant families linking the Scottish ballad tradition to America is the Ritchie family of Viper, Kentucky. The most documented member of the family is Gene Ritchie, who is largely responsible for the widespread use of the Appalachian or mountain dulcimer, the only stringed instrument native to the United States.
Bang 'em rid by the riverside, dill 'em down, dill 'em. Three young ladies there he spied, dill 'em down, dill 'em. Killy-caw, cuddle down, killy-caw, corn.
For nearly 70 years, Jean was able to share the wide breadth of her family's musical history, preserving over 300 songs from the British Isles. Jean moved to New York City in 1946. Word of her musicality and family lineage spread through the local folk community by way of Alan Lomax, leading her to meet Mo and subsequently record on 15 Folkways albums.
On a May morning, on a May morning, right early.
Jean was also the recipient of a Fulbright scholarship and traveled as a musicologist to the British Isles and released two albums of those recordings, titled As I Roved Out, Field Trip Ireland, 1960, and Field Trip England, 1959, both released on Folkways Records.
We shall
During the Civil Rights era, Mo was the only record label owner who dared to cover the movement and spread the awareness of marginalized and prejudiced groups of people. To accomplish that, he needed someone in the field. In 1960, folk musician and musicologist Guy Carawan had reintroduced the African-American spiritual We Shall Overcome to the movement, and it quickly took hold as a freedom song, along with several other spirituals. More important to Guy was recording and archiving the freedom songs that were naturally occurring and the evolution of the movement. So, Mo gave him a tape recorder and the Folkways platform.
Ain't you got a ride?
Ain't you got a ride?
Yes, we've all got a ride.
things you gotta
ride. He was very, very strongly committed to the civil rights movement. There's no doubt about it. You have to think also that he was putting this stuff out simultaneously to when the events were happening. And that was brave.
Mo released a record including the voice of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in Birmingham soon after it happened.
I have had many experiences in my relatively young life, but I have never in my life had an experience like I am now having in Birmingham, Alabama. This is the most inspiring movement that has ever taken place in the United States of America.
Sing for Freedom, the story of the Civil Rights Movement, featuring a talk by civil rights activist and NAACP field secretary Medgar Evers just a short time before he was assassinated.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's very good to see the number of persons out here tonight that are. And certainly this indicates that we are ready for freedom and we're ready to march for it. Yeah. I just want to say to you here tonight that the reason I'm up here is because you've given us inspiration in Jackson. And we're going to go back to Jackson, South Mississippi, and all over Mississippi and fight for freedom as you're fighting for it here in Greenwood.
He put out the Selma, Alabama sit-ins as they were occurring. Black voices from the town of Greenwood, Mississippi, where the Student Nonviolent Coordination Committee fought for voter registration rights and assembled more than 80,000 blacks to vote in the Freedom Ballot Campaign of 1963.
We worked all of March, and as was to be expected, there was more violence. Sam Block and Willie Peacock were shot at in front of the office one night as they were parked, having come back from the church where they were getting together a clothes shipment. White men drove up close by the car, took a shotgun and blasted through the windows, so close that the pellets didn't have a chance to spread out. And luckily,
he put the Watergate hearings out as they were occurring.
Certainly the duty of this committee is to seek out the truth, to gather all the evidence we can from every witness. Matter of fact, I think the committee would be very derelict if it didn't get all the evidence it could. Let's turn to the...
Mo also put out a record of Senator Joe McCarthy talking, including commentary from filmmaker Emil D'Antonio, who describes how McCarthy used the big lie technique, resulting in witch hunts of academics and creatives during the second Red Scare.
One communist among the American advisors at Yalta was one communist too many.
But it was really taking a stand at a time when very few media outlets were. And he also took pleasure in putting out stuff that he felt no one else would put out.
Chair declares Richard M. Nixon, the Republican nominee for vice president, by acclamation.
Arguably, the most unsung hero of Folkways Records and its legacy is Marion Dissler. Though it was a fiction that Marion was the founder of Folkways in order to get it off the ground, by all accounts, Marion was his partner. Without her, Folkways simply could not have existed the way that it did. Over her 23 years with the company, she took care of both the artists and Mo, despite constant public backlash from him. Marion had been dealing with depression for decades, and her only relationship in her adult life was being a mistress to Mo. After several attempts, Marion fatally committed suicide at the age of 45. Hey folks, it's that time again. Have you listened to these interjections and thought, I should do that, or maybe I will at some point, and you haven't yet? Well, why not right now? American Songcatcher is a completely independent, listener-supported show, so the only way that these episodes happen is through our super kind supporters on Patreon, and we need more of them, just like you. Please visit patreon.com/AmericanSongcatcher or click the show notes in this episode. Thank you for listening. Now, back to the program.
Now tell me who, baby, who that been fooling you?
During the 1970s, Folkways continued to push the needle forward and cover more ground with the Ethnic series, both in America and abroad, under the direction of ethnomusicologist Harold Corlander. There were 6 records with David Nzomo, a student of Columbia University, who recorded traditional Kenyan songs from his childhood in Swahili, Kikamba, and English, including songs of work, protest, gospel, and dance.
Kipenzi changu changamke sasa mimi wako.
Mo also expanded the jazz catalog and explored more spoken word, such as soul poet, singer, and teacher Nancy Dupree, who recorded a live album called Sweet Thunder, Black Poetry. The album communicates a vivid, personal, and cultural story of anger, betrayal, and disgust, and other times, one of joy, celebration, and humor.
My people is ignorant,
selfish, and cruel.
Folkways also released an empowering record with Nancy called Ghetto Reality with her students in Rochester, New York during the 1970s. The songs that they chose honored icons like James Brown and Jelly Roll Morton, and highlighted the children's intangible assets, and spoke of a quest for civil rights.
I want my freedom! I want it now! Don't tell me about tomorrow! I want it now!
A decade after it was first introduced in Germany, Folkways also released one of the first records of electronic music from the University of Toronto. The Ethnic series also covered traditional Japanese music, featuring a single-stringed instrument called the ichigenken. Folkways remained very active towards the end of the 1970s, as the civil rights movement turned into the anti-war movement, and more independent record labels popped up, inspired by the Folkways model. Mo slowly began to pull items off the shelf that hadn't been released, including songs by Woody Guthrie, and an interview with acclaimed Pan-African sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois, the first African-American to be awarded with a doctorate degree from Harvard.
In the earlier days, in the latter part of the 18th century, in the beginning of the 19th century, the Negroes in America considered themselves African. They called their organizations African. There were African clubs.
By 1980, at 75 years old, Mo needed help, whether he asked for it or not, for Folkways' sake.
Sam Charters came back at the end to help Mo run the label.
Mo grew increasingly aware of the need for his life's work to not only be preserved, but to continue forward with the mission that he set out. He'd actually been considering different options to sell Folkways since the mid-1960s, and reportedly even had a buyer offer $1 million for the Folkways rights and inventory, though it fell through on Mo's end.
Going back over the entire length of the label, he had tried to make various deals that would ensure his independence. It was clear that he had to do something to ensure the legacy of the label.
The idea was Mo was, you know, looking for a place for it, and a bunch of people were in the running.
He had a pretty high bar for any organization to qualify and meet his demands.
A nonprofit
that didn't work either because he couldn't do certain albums.
This is Michael Ash again, Moe's son.
He tried to work out if there was a group of people who could just take it over, but there was no way out for him.
The main stipulations that Moe laid out were that every recording would remain available to the public, that unreleased master tapes in the Folkways archive should be explored, and that no titles were to be deleted. Everything was to stay in print.
So there were a number of people who were trying to help Moe. And Moe, you know, he was difficult to deal with for a number of reasons. You know, he was a handshake kind of guy, and he had to trust you.
At one point, Moe offered the collection to his son, Michael, who was a professor at the University of Alberta at the time. Instead, Moe and Michael donated one of each record in the collection to be accessible for scholars, faculty, and students at the university, which is still there today. Rutgers and Dartmouth were also in the running to take it on, but the conditions that Moe had, in addition to being hard to work with, stopped nearly every negotiation.
And there was a couple other record companies, but they, you know, they were really interested in cherry-picking out the Woody Guthrie's and Ella Jenkins records. And, you know, sounds of the steam engines is probably going to, you know, going to go out of print forever. So his stipulation that everything stay in print in some form or fashion was almost impossible for anybody maybe besides us.
Then Ralph Rinsler at the Smithsonian Institute came into the picture, who, in addition to being a talent scout for Newport Folk Festival, was running the Smithsonian Folklife Festival.
My mentor, Ralph Rinsler, going out and finding all the traditional musicians, like he's the guy who found Doc Watson, for one. Somehow he ended up talking to Moe, and, you know, and he said, well, you know, we'd be interested.
Ralph had to lobby hard, because the higher-ups at Smithsonian at the time didn't understand the idea of collecting sound recordings, which is kind of hard to fathom now.
If there was any organization that could do it or willing to do it, it would certainly be a nonprofit, you know, government agency.
This is John Smith.
I am the associate director at Smithsonian Folkways Recordings, the nonprofit record label of the Smithsonian Institution.
So when the Smithsonian told Ralph that they were interested, they told him that if he raised enough money, they could make it happen.
There was a musical advisor to the Smithsonian.
A famous jazz director and composer named Gunther Schuller.
He wrote a scathing letter saying they shouldn't do business with Moe. Moe was a thief. He was a pirate. You know, he would be making a deal with the devil, and that almost scuttles the deal. And if Rinsler hadn't been there, it never would have happened.
Raising enough funds to take on a massive collection like Folkways was no easy feat, so Ralph needed help.
So there was a chance meeting, apparently, at our Folklife Festival in 86 in the summer.
Ralph received a message on his walkie-talkie saying, there's a friend of yours down here.
And Ralph said, well, who is it? I'm not going to run down just for anybody. So, no, you really want to come down and see this person? And, all right. So he went down. It was Bob Dylan.
Ralph casually mentioned that he was trying to raise money for the Smithsonian to acquire the Folkways catalog, and that he was thinking of doing a tribute album with Columbia Records.
Dylan got involved.
If you gather around me, people, a story I will tell about pretty boy floating out long. Oklahoma knew him well.
It was called A Vision Shared, a tribute to Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly, released in 1988, and featured contributions by Pete Seeger, Taj Mahal, Emmylou Harris, Bob Dylan, Arlo Guthrie, Bruce Springsteen, U2, John Mellencamp, Willie Nelson, Sweet Honey and the Rock, and others.
And that raised a lot of the money that Ralph needed to bring the collection in.
Moe had a range of health complications that he kept mostly to himself, especially towards the end of his life, namely a long-standing heart condition.
He had this heart attack in his 50s. It's kind of amazing that he survived it, because this was the prime age for someone to suddenly die. But he survived that, and then he had a really bad fall, I think right after that, which hurt his leg again.
Well, by the time I was working for him, he was almost completely deaf. He had had already several heart attacks, and even his mode of affectionate expression was to sort of yell at you. So you get Mo on the phone, and Mo had one of those ancient black rotary phones, and you pick it up and go, yeah, what do you want? And then, you know, you're, okay, slam.
He developed type 2 diabetes and suffered several strokes.
And ultimately, in his later years, the diabetes was the more serious problem. He got weaker and weaker because of the diabetes.
And it's pretty amazing that he was still able to run the label really up to the last minute.
By the mid-1980s, Mo was still putting out records, and his family became more and more concerned. Though he was confined to a wheelchair and growingly incapacitated, Mo had his wife, Frances, wheel him into the office, and she helped run operations, which produced friction between her and Sam Charters, who by now was essentially running the show. In more ways than one, during Mo's final days, the world of folkways was hanging in the balance, and the deal with the Smithsonian Institution was postponed. It was sudden, yet expected. After a string of strokes, at 81 years old, Moses Ash died of a heart attack on October 9th, 1986, before a deal was made. Mo's funeral was held in the Lower East Side, in the same neighborhood where his career in radio and electronics began.
Let it be, dear Lord, let it be.
At the time of his death, Mo had amassed 2,168 recordings, as well as several other items that he collected between 1926 and 1986, including correspondence with recording artists and producers, artwork, photographs, clippings, production materials, writings, and business papers. Above all, Mo feared that his legacy wouldn't be alive for more than 5 years after he died, that some for-profit company would piece it apart and take only the marketable material. So even in the face of death, he refused to part with his collection. Luckily, Mo's family and lawyer kept his interests top priority, and a deal was completed in 1987, creating a new nonprofit called Smithsonian Folkways Recordings.
Just from the kitchen,
Shoo-lie-loo.
With a handful of biscuits,
Shoo-lie-loo.
Oh, Miss Bessie,
Shoo-lie-loo.
Fly away over yonder,
Shoo-lie-loo.
Just from the kitchen.
Shoo-lie-loo.
A year after Mo's death, ethnomusicologist Tony Seeger and archivist Jeff Place were hired to begin organizing and cataloging the collection. When Jeff first saw what it looked like, he had what he calls his, quote, Rumpelstiltskin moment.
I walked into this giant room full of boxes stacked to the ceiling everywhere, and that was Folkways, right? Well, I was basically asked to turn this into an archive. So I had to go through all these boxes, and Mo was so completely disorganized that everything in boxes wasn't related to anything next to it. It was just crazy.
If you were looking at the catalog and trying to find out, like, where is this album that I'm looking for, sometimes it wouldn't even have the album title. It would just say folk songs. It was like the Rosetta Stone. You'd sit there for hours with the catalog trying to figure out, you know, which records were which.
For Jeff and his team, it would take most of the 1990s to get through the collection. The first things that he went after were digitizing the original acetate discs and some of the glass-based and fragile items.
And I didn't get to talk to him, so I get to try years trying to figure out what stuff was. But I organized all the paper and all the recordings. Cataloged it all. I think there's about 50,000 database records in there now.
Wading through the deep waters of Moses Ash's day-to-day was full of fascinating discoveries.
Well, the famous one is the Woody Guthrie acetates. This Land Is Your Land, as people now know, had other verses in it, and initially they were political verses. And he said that he never recorded them, that it didn't exist. And so I was one day, was just, you know, dubbing this thing, and there it was. There's the political verses. I'm like, wow, you know, this exists.
There was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. Sign was painted, said private property. But on the back side, it didn't say nothing. This land was made for you and me.
With direction and curation from Tony Seeger, who had spent decades prior engrossed in ethnomusicology, anthropology, archiving, and producing traditional music, the collection was in very capable hands.
Tony Seeger, he was so familiar with, you know, what Mo wanted to accomplish, and he did it. You know, I mean, he was able to put together a system that met the demands of keeping everything in print.
If you lose your money, I'll be gone to your mind.
Despite the fact that Mo was the engine of Folkways, the relationships he had around him helped maintain the train, the key for longevity. After Marion Distler passed away, there were big shoes to fill.
There was a black woman named Marilyn Conklin who was extremely important. And she brought a lot of people like Nikki Giovanni and a lot of the black culture stuff. I mean, Mo was a big supporter of African-American artists, writers. I mean, it's not that he wasn't involved with that stuff, but Marilyn, again, she was kind of the public face.
Mo's father, Sholem, was also a lifeline that kept him afloat a time or three.
When my father, he went out of his way to loan me money when I needed it. That's very important. Very. Without that, you lose hope sometimes.
Anybody else would have given up. And with good reason. So, you know, he did everything backwards, and it shouldn't have worked, and that's why it's such a wonderful thing.
Turn around and go back home.
Should work out. And all the money coming into Folkways outside of royalty payments will be for the purpose of perpetuating the material. And it should be enough.
As early as 1946, in an interview with Time magazine, Mo said, "I'm not interested in individual hits. To me, a catalog of folk expression is the most important thing." His business model was one of a kind. Spend $0 on advertising. Compensate artists up front, perhaps never again. Keep every title in print. And steer clear of hit songs.
He absolutely refused to have a hit. And what he told me is, "I don't like a hit because you have to change your entire production line in order to catch the wave." And when things got too popular, like, he looked to offload it as quickly as he could to some other company.
The work he was doing was so unique because it was in an industry that was for profit. And he was, you know, he obviously had to make money, but, you know, a lot of times it wasn't his first priority. But putting out an album a week for, on average, for close to 50 years. I mean, that's pretty remarkable.
Mo famously never turned away from an interesting recording opportunity. But how did he make it work, considering what we know of how to sustain a record label today?
So he liked records that sold extremely poorly over a long period of time.
He had gone bankrupt once, and he didn't want that to happen again because it was really, really tough. So he was always worrying about his bottom line.
Another key ingredient was ambiguity. Mo created many companies to move finances and titles between.
He had something called Union Records for about 5 minutes. He had a label called Folk Music Records for about 5 minutes. He had a children's label called Cub for about 5 minutes.
If he ran into any kind of financial problem, Mo could be very fluid at creating alternative businesses to manage his story and redirect cash flow. If he had to dance to keep it going, he'd waltz.
When I was working for him, one day I came up and they were taking the Folkways name off the door and putting up a sign that said Blue Giraffe. And I said to Mo, you know, "Hey, what's going on here?" And he goes, "Don't worry, in a week it'll be Folkways again." and probably no one will ever know the mysteries of its corporation and the various different entities that he created.
Another strategy was capping inventory, which likely started after his ordeal with the Nat King Cole record. Moe was only trying to sell a handful of thousands of different titles, as opposed to selling thousands of only a handful of titles.
He had relationships with people, particularly record pressers, where he could gang pressings.
He did really short runs on records.
And so, like, he could do 10 of this and 20 of that.
Whereas other people would have to get a minimum of 500.
In the morning we built the city.
In the afternoon walked through its streets.
Evening saw us leaving.
Moe had quirks, both in and out of the studio. He didn't like stereo, a sound technique used to create a more three-dimensional sound, because it, quote, lied about the location of the performers. But evidence shows otherwise.
He was a man of contradictions. One of his things he kept saying to me was, stereo is a lie. Mono is the real thing. But he put out quadraphonic records.
He didn't want the engineer to manufacture anything, just document the sound. And he definitely didn't want the engineer to have more power than the artist. So nearly all the recordings for Folkways used one microphone for an entire performance, relying strictly on musicianship. For Moe, it was about having one take, and any outside sounds that made their way into the microphone and on the recordings were just part of the story. Additionally, Moe never told musicians what to do, how to play, or record when they were in his studio, which didn't work for some, like Burl Ives, but was the exception for many artists. Pianist Mary Lou Williams said, if you only burped, Moe would record it.
Most of them actually appreciated the fact that he gave them complete freedom, and he never interfered with what they were doing. In fact, they told stories of him literally just turning the recording equipment on and then going out and getting a cup of coffee. And Moe never interfered with content. He never told me what to do. If he trusted you, you could bring him a tape. He didn't even listen to it. It just went out. I know that he never listened to any record I produced.
Don't your house look lonesome? Your biscuit roller done gone. Don't your house look lonesome when your biscuit roller done gone.
Moe Ash was an idealistic workaholic who could rub people the wrong way in a hurry. He was a complicated figure, quick to anger, likely associated with his parents' absence as a child. He didn't allow anyone into his internal world.
He didn't bring you into his worries about anything. He just kept on going. Like, you know, I'm not going to worry about that. I'm just going to keep pushing.
He was defensive, always seemed older and more Scrooge-like than he should be for his age, and many experienced a rage that could boil over at the drop of a hat.
He threw an African sculpture at me once when got into a discussion of whether stereo was valid. You know, he reminded me a lot of my grandparents and relatives of that generation, that he was very stubborn, but in his vision.
The secretary talked about him like chairs flying out of the door of his office.
He wasn't a big guy for, you know, how you doing?
She got the same old jealousy she had 40 years ago.
But the main complaint among those who recorded for him was that Moe was too casual when it came to paying royalties. A lot of the time, he'd give an advance after the recording session, then nothing afterwards.
Oh, what a beautiful city. Oh, what a beautiful city, great God.
It wasn't like he was selling thousands of records and pocketing money from these poor artists. Now, there were people like Dave Van Ronk, you know, who became more successful, and Moe kept reselling his recordings later on. You know, Van Ronk tells that great story, or told the great story about going up there and saying, you know, I need a new coat, and Moe went and got him a coat from the back rather than give him. But that's a typical Moe gesture, but it was typical also. I mean, the way the music industry was working, and Moe was always struggling to stay afloat.
Or the other thing would happen is someone would send him a tape and say, you know, are you interested in doing something with this tape? And a month later, they get an LP of it and, you know, a $100 check in the mail and said, here you go. And they didn't even know he was going to put it out, you know.
Moe also said that he hated multi-tracking, but one infamous story refutes that regarding an album called The Sounds of the Tropical Rainforest, released on Folkways in 1952, produced by Moe and Peter Bartok.
His brother worked for the Museum of Natural History, John Ash, and they decided they were going to do a display on the tropical rainforest, and this was like really quite innovative. They wanted to have a soundtrack, like, you know, that would play behind the exhibit of the actual sounds of a rainforest. So John Ash said, oh, my brother Mo, he's an engineer, he can do that. And Mo said, sure, I'll do it. But he had no money to go to Brazil. He didn't. So he went to the Bronx Zoo with Peter Bartok. And the two of them said, well, what animals are in the rainforest? And Mo said, okay, we'll record all these different animals and birds and whatnot. And he said, which ones sing at which time of day? We'll make it like a sequence, like, you know, in the early morning, you hear the Waka-Kiki birds or whatever. And then they said, well, what other kind of sounds are in the rainforest? And they said, well, you know, the heavy rain. And so they put a whole bunch of wet towels at the bottom of Mo's shower and recorded that sound and overtracked it into the recording for the sound of the rain falling. So they play it for the museum. The museum officials say, this is wonderful, you know, great job. But you left out the crickets. And Peter Bartok goes, oh, no problem. I live in Connecticut. So he goes up the next night and records crickets in his backyard. They add that. So the opening night comes. It gets written up in the New York Times. I don't know if it was absolutely the first, but it was one of the first to have that feature. But as they were leaving, someone came up to Mo and said, this is a fraud. And Mo said, what do you mean it's a fraud? He goes, I'm an entomologist from Brazil. Those are not Brazilian crickets. Those are North American crickets.
Of course, there were other stories, too.
When our kids were young, my mother and father would come to Edmonton to visit us, maybe once a year. And he would insist, as he always did, no matter where he went, on staying in a hotel. And Edmonton is 2 hours behind New York, but he never left New York time. So he was able to persuade the kitchen to serve him breakfast at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning, because that was 7 o'clock in New York. And he wanted to be up before the mail came in so he could find out what was going on. So his assistant would be in New York. It would be 7 o'clock, 7:30. He'd be there in the restaurant, persuading the staff that they had to really shift their entire worldview.
When Folkways released a record of national anthems from around the world, including the United States national anthem at Yankee Stadium, Mo got a letter from the Yankees' lawyer for not getting permission. He simply replied, "The national anthem belongs to the people of the United States." Some discoveries that archivist Jeff Place made were unique to Mo's quest of capturing all sounds.
One of my favorites is you know, Mo, of course, he has his sound effects series, you know, sounds of frogs and sounds of dolphins and things like that. And he had a recording called Sounds of Cats. And he said it was an acetate. There was always cats squawking and fighting. And then there was some narrator guy who sounded like Don Pardo, who was kind of describing these two cats who were kind of doing this mating ritual. I'm like, oh, X-rated cat recordings. That one never came out, you know.
As Mo told folk music figure Izzy Young in a 1970 interview, "For what I stand for, I die. But for what somebody else tells me I stand for, I object."
So when you think about it, it's really an amazing achievement. And he really does deserve a lot of recognition for what he did. It's interesting how in the academic world, he doesn't have a lot of street cred, even to this day.
Mo sought out to provide a pure experience of sound. And for him, there was no distinction between the voices of humans and the sounds of the world. So the pure experience was limitless. In addition to the genres already mentioned, Mo also released records of country blues, jug bands, Kentucky mountain music, Negro folk music of Alabama, Cajun swing, sea shanties, War of 1812 ballads from America, and songs of American Indians. Folkways published music from every continent and worked with iconic American folk artists, including ones not mentioned yet in this episode, such as Bill Monroe, Suni Paz, Doc Boggs, Roscoe Holcomb, Oscar Brand, Peggy Seeger, Ewan McCall, and Bob Dylan, under the pseudonym Blind Boy Grunt. Mo also worked with the top names in early and revival blues, including Elizabeth Cotton, Reverend Gary Davis, Champion Jack Dupree, Honey Boy Edwards, Snooks Eaglin, Memphis Slim, Big Mama Thornton, Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, Mance Lipscomb, and Mississippi Fred McDowell.
Lord, my head don't hurt me, baby. Just my back inside.
He recorded talks with writers, poets, and humanitarians such as Margaret Mead, W.E.B. Du Bois, Gandhi, Allen Ginsberg, and even a psychedelic experience with Timothy Leary, who famously said in the 1960s, "Turn on, tune in, drop out."
You are now about to begin the great adventure, the journey out of your mind.
Tú eres mi sol, mi amor, mi único sol. Me haces feliz si el día está gris.
Since the acquisition, Smithsonian Folkways has not only carried Mo's legacy, but built it up. They've added more than 300 recordings, and in 2005, made much of the collection available online, thanks to a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation. In a lot of ways, the mission is the same, with different circumstances.
He did play a little fast and loose with some things sometimes, so we aren't able to churn out as many recordings as Mo was able to do. There are things we have to abide by. I mean, we also have to abide by just the basic bureaucracies of federal government, procurement and other things that Mo just did not have to deal with. So that's probably the biggest difference, you know, but it also allows us to do some things that you know, Mo wasn't able to do. So, you know, we are able to reach wider audiences. And I think Mo would be proud of that. I think the fact that we were able to expand on his vision of documenting the world of sound, but we're not just documenting the world of sound, we're reaching the world with it.
I think that they've done, you know, incredible, important work in preserving that mission and also taking on related labels, making all this material still available in its original form.
Well, you know, we thought, you know, we wanted to keep going what he did, the breadth of it, because, you know, he considered it an encyclopedia of sound.
Go to sleep, you weary hobo. Let the towns drift slowly by.
In the mid-90s, Jeff Place and Guy Logsdon at Smithsonian Folkways put together a compilation of all the recordings that Woody Guthrie and Mo did together, released on a 4-CD box set of over 100 songs, called Woody Guthrie, The Ash Recordings, Volumes 1 through 4. These are among the richest and most representative set of Woody Guthrie recordings ever assembled, carefully selected. Thankfully, Mo preserved the masters, which allowed Smithsonian Folkways to present the best of them to the public, as they had never heard him before.
do not think about tomorrow. Let tomorrow come and go.
Tonight. You'll sing a song, and I'll sing a song, and we'll sing a song together. You'll sing a song, and I'll sing a song, in warm or wintry weather.
In 1995, at the direction of Tony Seeger, Smithsonian Folkways released a collection of 23 tracks by Ella Jenkins called Multicultural Children's Songs. That record has outsold recordings by Woody Guthrie, Pete Seeger, and Lead Belly combined, and it's the second best-selling Smithsonian Folkways release ever, second only to another Ella Jenkins record, You'll Sing a Song and I'll Sing a Song. In keeping with Moe's insistence on documenting historical moments, when the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2002 after 9/11, Smithsonian Folkways spoke. They released A Voice of Iraq in Rahim Alhaj, a virtuoso oud player and composer whose music has a gorgeous movement that tells about real people and their lives in Iraq, and not the narrative pushed on the general public at the time.
And you remember what it's like when all the world's filled with light. Now do you have that in your sight? Spread it around, do.
Today, Smithsonian Folkways is as busy as ever. They've recently added works by songwriter and guitarist Charlie Parr, who grew up on the Anthology of American Folk Music collection and has an extensive record collection himself.
Folkways records have been part of my life. All my life, to be honest with you, they were part of my dad's record collection. I gravitated towards them early on. And I still listen to Folkways records on a regular basis, daily probably, if I really sat and thought about it. Collaborating with Smithsonian has just been an honor. They've been inspirational to work with. You know, the feeling that deep history and being part of a label that has been part of my life all my life is a very big deal to me.
Hey, what's the matter now? Please tell me, mama, what's the matter now?
They've also released a record with Grammy-winning songster and Carolina Chocolate Drops co-founder Dom Flemons, highlighting the history of black cowboys in America.
I mean, I can't overstate the influence that Moses Ash has had over my own music. I mean, the first time I ever heard Big Bill Brunzi, Trouble in Mind, just hearing those recordings just changed my life. And all of these albums came with very detailed liner notes that gave context for each of the songs, and that it allowed me to have a whole vocabulary to work with that I could change into my own style. I knew that Smithsonian Folkways was the only place that would allow for a proliferation of black Western culture on a folkloric level, so that it could then influence society and be interpreted on a popular culture level. And that's something that, again, goes back to my love of Moses Ash's work in making the label itself.
There's also been collaborations with another Carolina Chocolate Drops co-founder, Rhiannon Giddens, as well as Layla McCalla, Amethyst Kia, and Allison Russell, collectively known as Our Native Daughters.
Mama's crying long,
and she can't get up.
Mama's crying long,
and she can't get up.
Mama's hands are shaking,
and she can't get up.
Mama's hands are shaking,
and she can't get up.
In late 2022, Smithsonian Folkways released an album with celebrated mandolinist Sam Bush covering the music of progressive bluegrass pioneer John Hartford, as well as Canadian folk and old-time duo Ferris and Jason, traditional bluegrass outfit Poe Ramblin' Boys, as well as ethnomusicologist and composer Jake Blount, who explores traditional black religious music as it might exist post-climate crisis with his latest release, The New Faith.
Just as well to get ready, you got to die. Just as well to get ready, you got to die. It may be tomorrow, can't tell the minute nor the hour.
Mo once said, "My obligation is to see that Folkways remains a depository of the sounds and music of the world, and that these remain available to all. The real owners of Folkways Records are the people that perform and create what we have recorded, and not the people that issue and sell the product." Of the 2,200 plus records, only 200 of which were said to be profitable. No label has ever operated under the scope and scale, much less the eclectic sweep of Folkways. For over 40 years, Moses Ash created an audio archive like no other, an encyclopedia of sound.
That's what, to me, is his true legacy. It's the old Eastern European, go forth and be an irritant. You know, do stuff nobody else will do, and in a cunning way, and you leave a mark.
Just as well to love your enemies, you got to die.
As you sing, your voice makes a rhythm. And as you clap your hands to it, or skip to it, or dance to it, your body makes a rhythm. So you can make one rhythm, or two rhythms, or even several rhythms all at once sometimes. You can make rhythms that you hear, rhythms that you feel, or rhythms that you can see. Let's make a rhythm.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load six.
That's all for this special two-part episode on Folkways founder Moses Ash in collaboration with Smithsonian Folkways. This also concludes season two. Massive thanks to Richard Carlin, Michael Ash, Jeff Place, John Smith, as well as musicians Dom Flemons and Charlie Parr, for all lending your voices and your time. Also, big thanks to the Arhuli Foundation for permitting us to use audio from the incredible interview with Mo and Arhuli Records founder Chris Strachwitz, and to all the resources that made this episode possible over the last year of working on it. You can find links to everyone involved in the show notes. Also, one more friendly reminder that this program is listener-supported, and you can send a one-time donation or join the Patreon crew that keeps this program afloat at patreon.com/American Songcatcher. Just click the link in the show notes to find out more. Make sure to follow American Songcatcher on Instagram and TikTok at American Songcatcher. Our intro song is Payday by Mississippi John Hurt from the Today album. Our outro song is 16 Tons, performed by Tennessee Ernie Ford, originally written by Merle Travis. This episode was researched, edited, recorded, produced, and distributed by myself, Nicholas Edward Williams. In the words of Moses Ash, I try to do most of my heavy thinking work first thing in the morning. Here's to the songs of old. May they live on forever. See you next time on American Songcatcher.
If you see me coming, better step aside. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. One fist of iron, the other of steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.